Peter M. Sandman traces how he got his approach to risk communication in an interview with Margaret Harvey and Lewis Michelson on April 27, 2023.
So I have no idea how to introduce Peter Sandman. He is so many things to so many people, and he's been doing this for so long that he's well known around the world. I might let him he's gonna give us his background anyway about how he kind of got involved. But my name is Lewis Michelson, and I'm working with Margie. You wanna introduce yourself?
I'm Margie Harvey.
And we are doing these interviews for the benefit of ourselves. Current and future generations. So with that, we're changing the format a little bit from the ones we've done previously. We're just turning Peter loose.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And then, you know, after I've pre-associated for a while, I mean, feel free to interrupt if I'm going off topic, but for sure, let's, you know, circle back when I run out of things to say. And fill in the blanks and you know, see what else you want to get out of me.
It's just a delight to have you with us.
Well, thank you. It's a delight to be with you too, but it's a particular delight, obviously, for a retired old fart to look back at the history of how we got into this field and where the field went. So that, you know, that's more fun than talking about COVID risk communication, which I'm sick unto death of. So let me start in 1969, when I was a doctoral student at Stanford, and I had already picked my dissertation topic, which had nothing to do with risk communication. I was going to do my dissertation on why book publishers publish so many books that they know perfectly well won't make any money. And this is a lovely example of how things happen that you have no control over. At that point, Ronald Reagan was governor of California, and he hosted a speech by Nixon's Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Robert Finch, at Berkeley. I was at Stanford around the corner. And there were student demonstrators at Finch's speech. And Finch said, I don't see why these students are demonstrating. If you have something to say, why don't you, you know, get a research grant and study the things you want to do? And somebody pointed out to Finch that students didn't get research grants as a rule. And he said, well, that, you know, you should. If you have something, some research you want to do, send it to HEW directly to my attention. And if it's meritorious, we will fund it, because that's way more useful than demonstrating. And kind of as a lark, six graduate students, myself among them, put together a proposal to Finch to study various aspects of environmental communication. We were all PhDs working on PhDs in communication. None of us were working on environmental communication, but we were interested in the environment, and that was what the demonstration had been about. So we sent him proposals, and you know, he funded them all out of some slush fund. So I went and did my dissertation, as did half a dozen of my best friends. We all did our dissertations on various aspects of environmental communication because we got money to do it. And then we all went to, you know, to various universities, wherever we got jobs after we got our PhDs. And we did what newly minted PhDs do. We cannibalized our dissertations to get journal articles. And we continued to do research in the venue that we had launched our research in our dissertation. So I was publishing about various aspects of environmental communication. And we're now in the early 1970s. I am on the faculty of Ohio State University. I'm on the journalism faculty of Ohio State University, publishing in environmental communication. And I got a call from the School of Natural Resources of the University of Michigan. And they said, Would you come, are you interested in applying to come to the University of Michigan to run a master's and graduate program in environmental communication? And, you know, I said, gee, you know, why me? And they said, well, you know, we did a search, which was hard back, you know, we're in the early 1970s, you couldn't, the tools that we use take for granted now didn't exist. But we looked for somebody who's published on communication and environment, and you came up, and damn little else came up. You seem to be one of very, you and the people you went to graduate school.
I was going to say, what about the other five?
Yeah. You know, you guys are the only ones doing any of the, any research at that intersection of environment and communication. Mm-hmm. So I went, and what the School of Natural Resources was doing is launching a program essentially in how to be an environmental propagandist. This was, you know, immediately post Earth Day, and it was, how do you scare people about the environment? You know, and they wanted me to train, you know, the next generation of environmental activists, essentially, in propaganda. And that sounded like fun. And besides, they offered me $16,600. Wow. And I was getting $13,500, so that was a hell of a raise. And I interviewed for the job, and there were students in the search committee, and they said, "What is your commitment to the environment?" And I said, "I don't have much of a commitment to the environment, but you guys do. You know, my commitment will be to teaching you how to sell your commitment to people who don't share it. And you don't need me to share your commitment. You need me, you need to harvest my skills. You don't need my ideological conviction." And that almost cost me the job, but eventually they hired me, even though I wasn't a true believer. And cognitive dissonance being what it is, I became a true believer. You know, as you know, it's hard to train people to be environmental activists without kind of winding up thinking like you ought to be one.
I do have a question for you, Peter. You said they needed your skills. At this point, you're a professor, your PhD, you're writing. So when you say skills, what had you developed to that point that you thought was teachable to other people to actually put into action?
Well, my doctorate at Stanford was in public affairs communication.
Okay.
And it, you know, it was heavy on Maccabee and, you know, and attitude change stuff. It was pretty heavy on,
okay,
on how do you use media, right, to influence the outcome of events. So it was pretty much on target for what they wanted.
Got it.
So I moved, and I became, I trained the current head of past heads of a whole lot of environmental groups who came to Michigan to get master's degrees in environmental advocacy and environmental communication, and went on to do what they were preparing to do. And I [S2] Right. [S1] Trained a lot of them. And that's what I was. I did research on how do you scare people about the environment? I taught how to scare people about the environment.
I have to ask, did you train Natural Resources Defense Council?
Yes. Some people at NRDC.
I now see your work all over what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean Fred Krupp at EPA. I'm sorry, at Environmental Defense Fund was a student of mine. I mean, a whole lot of people now and in the recent past.
I'm sorry.
You know, went through my program.
The scare that they put out there about ALR and the apples.
Uh-huh. Textbook. Yeah. Yeah. They did good work.
I'm sorry, Margie, I'm enjoying this way too much.
So there I was, an expert on how to scare people, that takes us essentially to 19 into the 70s, and through the 70s I moved from Michigan after a while to Rutgers. for a variety of reasons that don't have a lot to do with this story, had to do with the end of my first marriage, but not a lot to do with this story. And I was doing a lot of consulting with environmental groups, with activist groups of various sorts, and research on how to be an activist. And then in 1979 came Three Mile Island. And I was asked by Columbia Journalism Review to cover the coverage of Three Mile Island, to go to Three Mile Island, you know, this was, you know, while it was happening, and follow the reporters around and write about, you know, the reporting and the flacking, write about what the, you know, what activists were doing and write about what the industry was doing and what the regulators were doing from a communication perspective. And I did that and wrote jointly with Mary Payton a cover story for Columbia Journalism Review that was almost the whole issue on that. And as a result of having worked at Three Mile Island, I got asked to be on the staff of the Kemeny Commission that investigated the accident. President Carter appointed a government commission to investigate how the accident was managed. One of the Kemeny Commission's mandates was to look at the communication. So they, you know, they staffed it up in a variety of areas. They were hiring epidemiologists and radiation physicists, and they hired me to work on the communication aspect of this. So I worked for the Kemeny Commission, only time I ever had subpoena power, interviewing all the key people that were either reporters or sources during the core weeks of this accident. This got me interested, you know, working at Three Mile Island got me very interested in how do you calm people down, which was not something I had previously been interested in. I mean, pretty obviously, there was no need to alarm people at Three Mile Island. They were already alarmed. They were arguably excessively alarmed. So somewhere, you know, between how do you guide them through this situation after they're alarmed and how do you calm them down so that they're not more alarmed than they need to be, were important communication questions at Three Mile Island. And you know, it came to my attention belatedly that this was, you know, that what I had been doing in environmental communication wasn't what was needed. I mean, if there were activists who thought it was what was needed. I hasten to add. I mean, there was an organization called Three Mile Island Alert that thought people weren't scared enough. But there was a good case to be made that the other side needed some attention at Three Mile Island. That calming people down and helping people cope were needs different from the ones I had been pursuing for the previous decade. Is this making sense?
It does, and it makes me wonder, is it just reversing what you were doing before? Or I'm sure it's much more complicated than that, but so where did that take you?
Well, it isn't just reversing what I was doing before, but it's an entirely different toolkit. You know, I mean, the toolkit for how do you scare people, you can't just put a knot in front of all of that and use it to reassure people. It's a completely different toolkit. It has much more to do with figuring out why they're upset, you know, and it led me to, you know, to the sort of the core intellectual observation that I made I mean, let me sort of interrupt the narrative to explain what it led me to. The correlation between how upset people are and how endangered they are is quite low. But the correlation between how upset they are and how endangered they think they are is quite high.
Right.
And what became sort of the core of my approach to risk communication is to look at the causal structure of that high correlation between what I came to call outrage and hazard perception. And what I learned is that it's not mostly the case that people are upset because they think they're endangered. It's much more the case that people think they're endangered because they're upset. You know, that outrage is the engine of hazard perception, much more than hazard perception is the engine of outrage. And therefore, I mean, if you're trying to get people to take precautions, the core task isn't to convince them it's dangerous. The core task is to get them upset. And if you get them upset, they will believe it's dangerous and they will take precautions. So it's not, you know, to try to influence the hazard perception in, you know, to manage the hazard perception in order to influence the outrage is bad causal structure. I mean, it's trying to influence the cause by manipulating the effect. And that's not good engineering and it's not good risk communication either. So I got very interested in, you know, if you want to calm people down, you have to stop upsetting them. And if you want to alarm people, you have to find ways to upset them. And you know, that's sort of the core intellectual piece of my approach to risk communication. And I, you know, by the time I got to Three Mile Island, it was already clear to me that if you want to get, you know, if you want people to take precautions, you got to get them upset, that you're not going to educate them into precautions. You have to alarm them into precautions. And that involves getting them upset. But I hadn't yet made the leap that if you want to calm them down, you have to stop pissing them off. Yes.
Let me ask you a question. So you're at Rutgers now, right?
Yes.
And you're still in academia.
Yeah.
You've done consulting. What I'm kind of wondering is these realizations that you came to, were they in situ when you were working with communities? Did you do social and kind of like social psychology experimentation or lab work to try and ascertain whether that's what was really going on? Like, how did you actually figure out that that's what was going on?
The experiential observation became what came first. I mean, you know, I was consulting, I was, you know, trying to make sense of what I was seeing and what I was recommending and what I was doing. And, you know, then I would, like an academic would, I would back up and try and find in the literature evidence that I was wrong or that I was right, you know, and test my observations against available social science evidence. But I was never, Lewis, I was never much of a researcher, frankly. I mean, I did research I worked with Neil Weinstein, so I did a lot of research with Neil on radon perception and radon communication. And I paid my dues, you know, I mean, I can manage, or at least in my heyday, I could manage a statistical package and make sense out of quantitative data, but it was never my thing. I was much more interested in figuring out what I think. The nice thing about having graduate students is then you could offer them a hypothesis and they would spend the next 2 years doing the study I didn't want to do.
I was just about to ask.
You know, because doing the study was never my greatest joy in life.
Interesting. Okay.
Let me get back to the narrative. There I was, beginning to get a sense that, you know, okay, scaring people is sometimes important. Reassuring people is also sometimes important, right, depending on your judgment, or in some cases, your employer's judgment of whether they are genuinely endangered and insufficiently upset, or very upset and excessively upset and not very endangered. So, you know, depending on your assessment of the actual situation, a very different risk communication toolkit is called for. Now, the other thing that happened at Three Mile Island is after I had worked at Three Mile Island, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission came out with a whole bunch of new regulations for nuclear utilities, some of which were communication recommendations that came out of the work I had done. And I started getting calls from nuclear utilities saying, can you come help us figure out how to implement our response to these recommendations, right. How to, you know, because they had new responsibilities to talk to their neighbors about nuclear risk. And they were saying, can you come help us figure out how to do that? And my immediate response was, I work with activists. I don't work with industry. That's not what I want to do, you know? And they said, well, you know, you help write these recommendations. Don't you have something like a responsibility to help us do it right? You know, and that was pretty convincing. So I actually started doing corporate consulting, which I had done virtually none of prior to Three Mile Island. One result of that is I was blackballed by a lot of environmental groups. I had, you know, my key constituency had been environmental groups. It seemed to me totally consistent that I would help environmental groups scare people when that was needed and help industry calm people down when that was needed. But it did not make sense to environmental groups. It did to industry. Industry never objected to the fact that I continued to work with activists. Activists objected strenuously to my being willing to work ever with industry. You know, so I lost a lot of my activist clientele, not all of it. I held on to Environmental Defense Fund, among others. But I lost a lot of my activist clients as I started working with industry. But I learned so much by doing both at the same time.
Sure.
By the early 80s, it was clear to me that you know, sometimes you had to do one, sometimes you had to do the other. I had not invented hazard versus outrage yet. My early frame was apathy versus hysteria. I'm embarrassed to say that, but I wrote articles about, you know, sometimes your problem is apathy and sometimes your problem is hysteria. I can't imagine, you know, in the 2020s using the word hysteria in that kind of value neutral way, but that's what I thought, that's what I wrote in the 1980s. But by the mid 80s, I was coining the risk equals hazard plus outrage formula. And I wrote a piece for EPA called Responding to Community Outrage that was sort of the beginning of my trying to identify what I called components of outrage, which Slovic and Lichtenstein and Bischoff had been calling components of or aspects of risk perception. And I argued it's not really risk perception. These are the things that get you upset. And when you're upset, you think the risk is serious, whether it is or not. But these are not components of the perception. They're causes of the perception. They're components of the upsetness. And that, you know, that's a distinction that made a big difference to me.
So some of our listeners may not be familiar with some of the things you're talking about. You want to state the equation just one more time for us?
Yes. The equation that sent my children to college and is going to send my grandchildren to college was risk equals hazard plus outrage. Hazard was my redefinition. I use the word hazard to mean what technical people use the word risk to mean. That is some, you know, the multiplication of magnitude times probability. You know, how bad is it and how likely it is it? You multiply those two. That's what risk assessors call risk, but I wanted a broader definition of risk, so I redubbed that hazard. And then what I called outrage was, you know, how upset you are. And the word outrage worked very well for environmental controversies. It didn't work nearly as well when I was working on, say, vaccination, pandemics, where, you know, it's much less about anger and much more about fear. So the word outrage, you know, was the ideal word for some of my clients, and it was kind of a misnomer for others of my clients. But you know, it made me famous, so I was stuck with it. Risk equals hazard plus outrage. I mean, a much broader way to say it is, you know, how serious you're going to think the risk is a function of how serious it is technically and how upset you are. Outrage isn't quite the right word. That plus sign isn't quite the right, definition of the function either. But that was the shorthand that I came up with in the mid 1980s. It wasn't very much longer before I realized that crisis communication fit in there as well. I mean, as soon as I started thinking, okay, you've got hazard and you've got outrage, it didn't take long to say, all right, let's think of it as a 2x2 matrix. Hazard is either high or it's low. Outrage is either high or it's low. And I developed, and the terminology shifted over time, but by the by the end of the 1980s, I had a sense that if it's high hazard and low outrage, the task is precaution advocacy, trying to get people more upset so that they will think the risk is greater than they thought it was and be more willing to take precautions or demand precautions or tolerate precautions. On the other side, if the other corner of this 2x2 matrix, if the hazard is low and the outrage is high, people are upset but not endangered. The task is outrage management, trying to calm them down rather than rile them up. And I'm going to come back to that. If they're both high, the task is crisis communication. If they're both endangered and upset, you don't have to get them more upset. They're upset enough. You have no business trying to get them less upset because the outrage is what's going to motivate them to take precautions, and you want them to take precautions because the hazard is serious. The outrage is just where you want it. It's fine. You don't have to mess around with it, but there are still communication tasks to be done. You have to help people bear their outrage. You have to help them bear the hazard. You have to help them choose wise rather than unwise precautions. Crisis communication is a third toolkit, by the end of the, at least by the end of the 80s, I had those three toolkits clear in my head. And of course, in contrast, if hazard is, and I'll finish this map, there you go. There it is.
I just thought I'd put it up just so that we could,
There it is.
I was just about to let the sweet spot.
I want to finish with two things down in the, no, keep that up there, if you will, for a minute, Margie. Down in the lower left-hand corner, low hazard and low outrage, that's not, there's no need to do risk communication. There is if you're only there temporarily. I mean, you might want to do pre-crisis communication or pre-precaution advocacy or pre-outrage management if you think you're headed in the months ahead to one of the other corners. But if you're permanently in the low hazard, low outrage corner with respect to a particular audience and a particular issue, there's not much risk communication to be done. The sweet spot, on the other hand, is where IAP2 lives. Finally, I get to talk a little bit about IAP2. The sweet spot, which I never did any work in until I started working with IAP2, hazard is intermediate, outrage is intermediate. People are, it's not a trivial risk, but it's not an urgent risk, so that they can afford to take their time, think about it, figure out what to do. They're not apathetic, but they're also not freaking out. They're interested. The public consultation paradigm is calm, rational people chatting with each other about a non-urgent risk. That is the sweet spot. That's what public consultation and the bag of tricks that, Lewis, that you helped develop is mostly, in my judgment, is mostly about. You know, so where risk communication intersects public consultation and intersects stakeholder relations is when people are very upset, and most public consultation happens in venues where people are very upset. That's when a company or a government agency says, oh, damn, you know, we've got people demonstrating, we've got people throwing rocks at our car, we've got people trying to stop us from doing what we want to do. I guess we better hire a public consultation person to come in here and help us deal with this upset public. So the paradigm of public consultation is calm conversation. The reality of public consultation is public consultation people get hired when there's an outraged stakeholder group that needs to be calmed down. So that, you know, there's an outrage management task that is a precondition for the public consultation task. That's not an understanding I had until much later. You know, so I mean, the sweet spot is the last thing that I figured out about this map of the relationship between hazard and outrage, and I figured it out with IAP2's help.
You know, it's interesting because there's a big difference between reducing outrage in order to make people stop caring and to stop bothering you versus reducing outrage so that you can have a conversation about it and maybe involve them in helping you make risk management decisions. And I think that's what was really interesting about that period when I joined the fracas, the fray, so to speak, in the mid 80s, was both of those were going on. There were both people who were peddling, here is how you calm them down and neutralize them so that you can do what you're planning on doing already because they don't know what they're talking about. And there were those of us in the, for example, the hazardous waste program in the U.S. called Superfund, which is where I was, which was all about empowering at some level the community to be able to work with you in order to make better decisions, which is the heart of IAP2, right? Making better decisions. So you're right. I do think that that was the contribution of those of us in this field in kind of changing the purpose. And finding a more noble purpose for outrage management.
I think that's right. And, you know, I mean, my collaboration with IAP2 came out of an awareness that, you know, public consultation people actually needed the outrage management bag of tricks as a predecessor to their bag of tricks much of the time. Not always. I mean, sometimes, you know, you walk into a room full of people who are ready to bargain with each other or you know, seek consensus or seek compromise, but quite often they're not ready for that. And I had the expertise in how to get them ready for that. But you're absolutely right. You know, most of my outrage management clients weren't trying to engineer a calm negotiation. They were trying to get people to go home. You know, so the, if you will, from your point of view, they wanted to overshoot. They not only wanted to get people calm enough that they were willing to talk, they wanted to get people so calm they wanted to go home and watch TV.
I think the other connection that you brought to mind about where the intersection is, this is fascinating discussion, isn't it, Margie? And you're welcome to join anytime, is that a lot of what's described in that article that we just took that image out of, talked about the idealized venue for these discussions that take place, which is the classic public meeting. And I think one of the other contributions, intersections was the participation field was saying, how can we bring people together in very different ways, in different formats, using different techniques, that the techniques themselves have a calming effect, have a conducive effect to a calmer, of which public meetings were probably the worst technique possible trying to do that. And so that's why all of these things, I think, came together and why there was such a strong bond and nexus between your work and the work we were doing focusing on the process of public participation.
And not wanting to get into the history, but I suppose it's worthwhile mentioning that it was like the Scottsdale kind of event, which was a training event that brought together Peter with the IIP2 community, and that would have been something like, I'm going to say 2007 maybe, or something like that. So I think that was the sort of bringing together, and it's almost like
November 2007. I looked it
up. That's right. So 2007. And so that was kind of a coming together of the minds in a way that, and I mean, it's interesting when I reflect, and I hadn't thought about this before, Peter, but when you're talking about the environmental groups, it's almost like a lot of people, I think, perhaps in the IIP2 community thought, well, we're actually, you know, we're actually very ideological, and we're really on the side of the community, and you were very much seen as the corporate. But the irony of that is that many of us as public participation practitioners were actually working for corporates. So we actually needed better ways to explain to our clients in ways that they could appreciate. So we actually needed that skill set and needed to bring that into the fore.
I mean, the paradoxes are amazing. I mean, you know, you were being hired, public participation people were being hired mostly by companies, but their heart was with the community. I was being hired by companies, but the main thing I was training them is how to listen to the community and how to stop pissing off the community. I mean, the core of outrage management, I mean, you know, the bag of tricks were things like, you know, share control and be accountable and acknowledge your prior misbehaviors and acknowledge your current problems, all those things. But the absolute core was stop being an asshole. You know, the core, we can use that word language like that on the tape, or would you rather
course,
I didn't?
Of course,
all right. I would sit with CEO after CEO, and I would say, they mistakenly think you're killing them because you're acting like an asshole. You know, you're being contemptuous, you're being dishonest, you're being, you know, you're acting like a jerk. I can clean it up a little. You're acting like a jerk, so they find it easy to believe that you're killing them. And you know, what you're thinking is, since I'm not killing them, I'm entitled to act like a jerk. And what they're thinking is, as long as you act like a jerk, we imagine that we're going to continue to think you're killing us. And what I would say, here's the deal I've got for you. If you stop acting like a jerk, they're very likely to stop thinking you're killing them. If you're actually not. I mean, it ain't going to work if they're dying. If the hazard is actually low and you stop doing the things that are making the outrage go through the roof, they will begin to notice that the hazard is low. And that's the payoff to you. So, I mean, what I was selling to corporations was kind of listening to these angry stakeholders and doing more of what they wanted, telling them that you have done more of what they wanted instead of pretending you did it because you wanted to, you know, giving them the credit for the things you made them do. So it seems to me we were both, the public participation people and I as an outrage management person, we were both taking corporate money to help the other side.
I do think I should mention at this point that I would say the greatest proportion of people in public participation work for government agencies, and which creates a different dynamic, because oftentimes the government's the perpetrator, if you will, but sometimes they're the ones, like in the Superfund program, EPA didn't create any of the problems, but they were left figuring out how to manage the problems and to clean up the problems. And so it's a different dynamic is all I'm saying, because but if they're not appearing like they care and they're being evasive and they're acting like jerks, it's still the same thing. In fact,
it's not as much of a different dynamic as it should
be. No, it's not, because then all they do is they transfer their outrage from the company who did it to the company, to the government agency that's supposed to be dealing with it.
Yes. And I very often said to corporate clients, you know, if you have a choice between stakeholders being angry at you and stakeholders being angry at the regulator, you're better off if they're angry at you. Because if they're angry at you, you can figure out how to calm them down. If they're angry at the regulator will get rid of that anger by screwing you. The regulator will respond to public outrage by not letting you build your whatever. And I at least half a dozen times in my career, I wound up training regulators at the expense of corporations that said, you know, that would say to me, we get it. We're beginning to understand what we're doing wrong, and we're beginning to start trying to do it right. But the regulator keeps doing it wrong. Can you help them? And I would say, sure, you know, if they hire me or if you hire me to help them. And sometimes that was not possible, but sometimes it was. One thing I want to do, if in case it's useful, is talk. It's about the only thing I want to do that I haven't done yet, is talk about different ways of parsing risk communication, different ways of splitting it. And I think probably the way to begin is when the term risk communication was invented, and it was invented at that you know, mid 1980s EPA conference that we were both at. When the term was invented, it was basically outrage management. Health communication already existed, and that, you know, safety communication, they were what I call precaution advocacy. Crisis communication already existed. EPA's, you know, had done a study some years before in which it had correlated, you know, the EPA's judgment of how serious risks were with the public's judgment of how serious those risks were, and correlated both of those with the EPA budget. And what they found is that they were spending most of their money on things that they didn't think were serious because the public did.
I remember that study.
It was called the Unfinished Business Study. And, you know, so EPA was very interested in how do we calm people down. And Superfund, of course, you know, Lewis, you were in the middle of this. Superfund sites where people were rightly upset, and there were Superfund sites where people were insufficiently upset. But most Superfund sites, the neighborhood was going bananas, and the hazard was pretty small. And in particular, when you started cleaning them up, the hazard got smaller, and the neighborhood got worse, got more upset.
I would say there was another factor, and that was data and science were inconclusive about whether it was or was not a danger.
I agree that there are often three and four and five orders of magnitude of uncertainty around the risk assessment.
And that's why the communication becomes even more important. That's why some of the rules that we developed for communicating in those situations was learning how to explain uncertainty to people, you know?
Yeah. And of course, the relationship between uncertainty and outrage is very well established, and it's bimodal. If you want to keep drinking coffee, the fact that they're not sure it gives you cancer is a reason to say, well, they're not sure, so I'll keep drinking it. If you think it's horrible that they're emitting dimethyl meatloaf out the stacks, the fact that we're not sure whether the dimethyl meatloaf gives you cancer tells you how dare they make me the subject of their experiment. How dare they emit something that they're not sure is safe? So uncertainty, you know, is a potentiator in both directions. If you want to be upset, it gets you more upset. If you want to be calm, it gets you calmer.
Yeah.
That's very interesting stuff.
Not to back us up too much, but my introduction actually started with risk perception. Some of the early work done, you know, again, I usually mention Brook, Fischhoff, and you know, Lichtenstein, those people. And is that the same? Do you feel like that's the same time when risk perception became kind of embedded in this whole field of risk communication? Because a lot of what you've talked about risk communication, to me, we're also talking the outrage factor, we're talking about risk perception.
Yeah, and that's what they called it. And, you know, they were a little earlier than, you know, I mean, I was building on them and building on Kahneman. When I was giving credit where credit was due, you know, it was Fischhoff and Lichtenstein and Slovic and Kahneman were the names that I really had to say, I'm standing on their shoulders. But I want to do this partition because I think it's useful. So So one set of distinctions that I don't need to talk about further is precaution advocacy versus crisis communication versus outrage management versus the sweet spot, which is stakeholder consultation or community engagement. But there are a couple of other, ways of parsing it that I think are important in the history of risk communication.
Okay.
One is, are you trying to educate or inform, or are you trying to persuade or activate? Are you neutral or do you have an outcome goal? Mm-hmm. And of course, there are people who have an outcome goal that are uncomfortable admitting it even to themselves. And, I sometimes had clients who said, I want to educate people on this issue, and particularly in precaution advocacy. I would have a precaution advocacy client that says, I want to educate people on, this risk. And I would say, well, suppose you succeed in educating them on the risk and they get much more knowledgeable about the risk, but they still don't give a damn and they still are uninterested in taking precautions. Will you feel you've done a good job? And they would say, well, no, if they're educated, they won't feel that way. If they're educated, they'll want to take precautions. And I would say, oh, so your goal is to get them to take precautions and education is your strategy. If that's true, let's look at the research on whether that's the optimum strategy. I'd have them by the short hairs.
That we're editing out right now.
But sometimes they really were only interested in education. I mean, sometimes there was no persuasion goal even when I dug under the surface. Mm-hmm. So I think that distinction is important. Are you trying to inform and educate and you do not have a stake in the outcome? You only have a stake in your audience knowing more. Or are you trying to influence, persuade, activate? You do have a stake in the outcome, in which case information is a tool and may not be your primary tool or may not be your most effective tool. That's the distinction I wanted to talk about. Another distinction I want to talk about is audience. Because throughout my career and still today, organizations silo their communication people, not according to strategy, but according to audience. So there aren't precaution advocacy people versus outrage management people versus crisis communication people, but there are public relations people whose audience is the great unwashed masses, versus stakeholder consultation people whose audience is the people who care and who are upset and interested, versus government relations people versus shareholder relations people. Mm-hmm. They parse it however they parse it. Those people are usually different people, and they're often in different departments. They often report to different management structures, so that you have to get very high in the organization before you get someone who is supervising both of them. So the silos are a huge problem. One of my clients for some years was the Resolution Mine in the US Southwest. And it's on my mind because it's back in the news. Oh. The stakeholder relations people were seriously trying to build trusting relationships with the Apache Nation that owned a key location where a spectacular copper deposit existed. I shouldn't say owned it. They used it. They had religious ceremonies from time to time at that location. While the stakeholder relations people were trying to forge decent relationships with the Apache so that they could negotiate some kind of win-win with the Apache, which was entirely feasible because this was not a hugely important site until outrage went through the roof. Meanwhile, the government relations people thought they had a much better way, and that is negotiating a land swap so that since this was government land, they could get through Congress a land swap where the mining companies give the government, you know, two or three times as much land in other locations, and the government gives the mining companies this land, which has this spectacular copper deposit. And, you know, they did the land swap in the dead of night. And they got it, and they came back to management. And we're talking about Rio Tinto and BHP, two huge international mining companies. And they went back and said, yay, you know, we did it. And I said, and the stakeholder relations people said, 20 years from now, you're still going to be fighting about this, because instead of building a relationship with the Apache, you have betrayed the Apache. And this land, which they barely cared about, is now going to be incredibly important to them, because that's what outrage does. And it's in the newspapers today. You know, yeah. And this is decades later. So the point is, those disciplines are siloed.
We have a colleague who's working on that right now. Yeah.
I hope he or she is making progress. I mean, you know, it's a win-win. It's an easy win-win once outrage is out of the way, but the, outrage isn't out of the way. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important. And the last way I want to partition this, and it's an overlapping partition, but it's a little bit different, is in terms of what do you do when you have a controversy? And it seems to me there are three approaches to controversy. My claim to fame, which is outrage management, is one of them, okay? And the essence of outrage management, in my judgment, is to try to get people who hate you to hate you less. Okay. A second approach, which is public relations, is to try to get people who aren't interested in you at all to like you a little. So it's aimed at a different audience, but it's also a very different goal. You know, whereas outrage management is trying to take very high levels of negative passion and reduce them. Public relations is trying to take very low levels, maybe non-existent levels of interest, and generate a little bit of positive attitude. You know, you're not trying to get people to be, you know, ardent supporters. You're just trying to get them to casually and uninterestedly think you're the good guy and that, you know, the other side is not the good guy. Okay. That's the second strategy for dealing with the controversy. And the third strategy is support mobilization. Try to get the people on your side to be more on your side. So if outrage management is to be less hated, support mobilization is to be more loved, to get the people who are already your allies more activated, you know, more willing to go to meetings, more willing to give money, more willing to tell their friends and neighbors that they should be on the same side. Those three, it seems to me, are, you know, if you're assuming you're not going to ignore a controversy, the three main ways of dealing with, you know, when you are the object of controversy is outrage management, support mobilization, and PR. And they aim at different audiences, and they aim at, they're very different toolkits, you know, and they're not only competing for time and effort and resources and things, you know, and things like that, and, you know, siloed personnel, but they're actually antithetical. When you do good outrage management, you're admitting things that if you're doing good public relations, you don't want people to know. When you do good support mobilization, you're saying things that are going to piss off the people who are already outraged at you and make them more outraged. For every combination of those three, for every two, you know, combination of two out of those three, they are in not just in competition for effort, but they're working at cross purposes. You can compromise them, but they are fundamentally at cross purposes.
I'm a little perplexed at this moment, because it's all of those seem to be from the standpoint of the person who has an objective to have people do things or not do things for them, as opposed to where you started, which was with the activists, because it seems to me the activists were trying to use support mobilization for their purposes in direct contradiction to what perhaps the other parties were. So can you
talk exactly right.
That?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, all three, support, mobilization, public relations, and outrage management, are available to the organization that wants to do something and is facing opposition.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, I think
that, yeah, that would be true of an activist organization or a government agency or a corporation. If you want to do something and you're facing opposition, you know, you can get the people on your side more involved. You can get the people against you less upset, or you can get the people who aren't very interested to casually think that you're right. And those are, it seems to me, the three dominant strategies. And, you know, I mean, look, a carpenter walks around with a hammer thinking everything's a nail. And my claim to fame is outrage management. So I'm inclined to think it works better, you know, than the other two. But there are obviously occasions when it's the wrong approach, and when one of the other two is the optimum approach for someone who is trying to get something done. And, there are a lot, you know, I mean, the distinction between wanting to be more loved versus wanting to be less hated. I mean, you think about applying for a job. And if there are going to be 50 applications and there's only one opening, you should write a very weird application letter because you need to stand out. You know, you want to be the one out of 50. And you take a risk of maybe, you know, irritating the person who's reading the letters. But if you write a plain vanilla application, there's no way you're going to be the one. If on the other hand, there are 50 applicants and 40 positions, and the person reading the applications is really just trying to weed out the obviously no good ones, then you want to write a vanilla application because you don't want to be one of the ones that gets weeded out. So, you know, in the first situation, you want to be more loved. In the second situation, you want to be less hated. So that, I mean, you know, those are, yeah, you know, I mean, there are times when outrage management is absolutely the wrong approach. And you know, one of the things that I needed to offer clients is not just guidance on how to do outrage management, but guidance on when to do outrage management and when they ought to be doing something else.
Margie, I think you had a comment or question.
Oh, I just can see that, you know, what you're describing as, you know, public relations really is probably what many people call public engagement. And, you know, some of that might be appropriate, but a lot of it is, you know, I mean, a lot of it is there's a cartoon that says, we don't have any budget for community engagement because we're spending too much time begging strangers to talk to us, you know, which is the sort of the social media thing of trying to get a whole lot of people kind of so that you can say nothing to see here. There's a whole lot of people that are really excited about what it is that we're doing. But, you know, so, I mean, I think, you know, this goes to the core of our thing. I think a lot of, you know, what we're frustrated on is that we're going round and round in circles and we sort of don't seem to be, you know, hearing the messages that I guess you're saying, Peter, and kind of, you know, finding different approaches. We're kind of perhaps, you know, doing the same thing over and over again and making the same mistakes. But,
well, I mean, the wisdom that public consultation people have that, that really didn't occur to me until I started working with public consultation people, is that folks who don't have much interest in an issue have wisdom to impart. And, you know, I mean, prior to working with public consultation, my thinking was, if people aren't interested, for God's sake, leave them alone. Don't try to get them interested. They might wind up against you. Calm down the people who are against you, maybe rile up the people who are on your side and leave the people who don't give a damn alone, was my approach. But, you know, public consultation people taught me if you're actually trying to figure out the best outcome, people who don't care need to be seduced into caring enough to come to meetings because they have wisdom that the heavily engaged people don't have. That had never occurred to me until I learned it.
But now we do have a lot of saying that, you know, we're over consulting people and, you know, we're wondering why they're not there. So, you know, that's a symptom of that. But anyway,
I wanted, I think,
Yeah, I think we should wrap up.
Sorry. Well, I want to connect us to one other thing in the outreach training, and it's also a portion of the certificate training, which is, you know, the staking out the middle and that concept. And I'm wondering, is that any way related to what we were just talking about?
It's certainly a core of outrage management. I mean, you know, I mean, one of the things that I routinely would say to clients is look, it's not symmetrical. You know, in a fight between incredibly dangerous and incredibly safe, incredibly dangerous will win because that's conservative. I mean, if you're not sure whether it's incredibly dangerous and incredibly safe, you better not take a chance, you know. But in a fight between incredibly dangerous and moderately dangerous, you stand quite a good chance of convincing people that moderately dangerous is closer to the truth. You know, so staking out the middle is a dumb thing to do when you're trying to alarm people. You're trying to alarm people, you should be as alarmist as integrity and credibility permits. But when you're trying to calm people, then staking out the middle is essential. You know, so that's the take on it that I would routinely use. I'm not sure where to take that in the context of the things we've been talking about, but okay. That's my basic point about staking out the middle.
So I do, because of the reason we're doing these interviews is because we want to find out how relevant versus dated some of these things that we've developed, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, whether they still resonate, whether they're still relevant. Just take a minute to speak to like your own experience about what you see in the world today, whether we've got any less or any more reason to pay attention to these things.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a modest amount of progress on the part of the corporate world in understanding that risk communication is important and that outrage management is important. I don't necessarily think that's because of me, but you know, I helped and others helped, and I think the main thing that helped is corporations kept getting crucified. Corporations kept doing it wrong and winding up in very deep trouble over very trivial hazards, which was a motive to try to figure out what they were doing wrong. So yeah. I think there's been some progress. I think there's been almost no progress in government. I think there's been almost no progress in public health in particular. You know, my I'm getting endless messages. I don't know why, but I'm going to turn off the volume on this. There we go. So I don't have to listen to it. You know, I mean, my work on COVID, you know, in the last couple of years has absolutely convinced me that, you know, corporations learned how to do risk communication in part because when they did bad risk communication, they reaped the whirlwind. Public health until COVID didn't reap the whirlwind. It was less likely to get caught in its dishonesty. It was less, when caught, it was less, more easily forgiven. You know, so that I think public health agencies and government generally got into much worse habits. That, you know, corporations kept being reminded that when they did it badly, you know, their projects failed. Government agencies and in particular public health didn't have that experience until COVID. And, you know, I kept saying, eventually this is going to come home to roost. Eventually your contempt for your public, your willingness to cherry pick facts in order to persuade people to take the precautions you want them to take, your dishonesty about the size of the hazard, it's all going to come home to roost sooner or later. And they would say to me, well, you know, hasn't yet, you know, we're getting away with it so far. I'll give you a concrete example. I can remember advising the polio eradication campaign that they needed to come out of the closet about the truth that the oral polio vaccine once in a million gives you polio, that it's a live vaccine that's been made weak, and occasionally it somehow manages to get strong again and causes polio. It's still, it's a great vaccine. It prevents a whole lot more polio than it causes, but it occasionally causes polio. And the polio vaccination campaign was explicitly lying about it. They would basically, parents would say, can this vaccine give my kid polio? And instead of saying one time in a million, they would say, absolutely not, it's impossible. And I kept saying, these are not stupid people. They have Google. They're going to catch you. And the polio vaccination campaign kept saying, no. If we admit that the vaccine can give you polio, we will have a much harder time vaccinating people. This lie is saving lives. Mm. And I lost that fight again and again and again until COVID. And now I think at last public health realizes that it has lost trust. And it's lost trust for the same reasons that corporations lost trust. So
we could have a much longer
I think we need to think about wrapping up. I've got another meeting. So are you okay is there anything else that you'd like to say, Peter, before I stop the recording?
No. Did I cover the ground you needed covered?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. But I'd like to say thank you very much, Peter, for the purposes of the recording, and but stay around.
Okay.